Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Klamath Tribes podcast. I'm Ken Smith. Today we're talking fish with Ambodot fish specialist Jordan Ortega. Welcome.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
When did you start your job? You're new.
Correct. Yep. I started, I believe, August 5th was my first day.
Well, not that new.
Not that new, but probationary period is not up yet. So still got a few more days.
Are you a tribal member, or what's your connection to the tribes?
No, I'm a non-tribal member employee, but I've been working with the tribes since I started work down here back in 2017 when I was an undergraduate field tech out of Oregon State University.
What was your major?
My major was fishery science.
Bachelor's?
Yep, bachelor's.
And your specialty is it an anadromous fish?
So my background, where most of my observations and experience comes from, studying the Red Band of Upper Klamath Lake.
Oh, very specialized.
Yeah, but we approached, so in starting back in 2019, I started my PhD, my dissertation on the early rearing ecology of Red Band trout of Upper Klamath Lake.
The what?
The early rearing ecology of juvenile Red Band trout of Upper Klamath Lake. And we focused that research in such a way that the questions we were answering would inform anadromous recolonization of the Upper Klamath Basin. So we were trying to ask questions about juvenile salmonids, particularly the Red Band trout, trying to understand what habitats across the basin function to support rearing of salmonids.
What is that term again?
Salmonids. Sorry, I'm using too much terminology.
That's okay. It's my job to figure it out.
Salmon and trout.
Oh, okay.
So we used the upper basin's Red Band trout as kind of a proxy to better understand how future anadromous fishes might be using habitats in the Upper Klamath Basin.
So that was 2019.
Yep. Well, the work began in 2017 on similar kind of auxiliary projects, but I didn't start my PhD until 2019.
So do you have a PhD as well now?
No, I just finished my preliminary exams. So I just have to, I have about a year left. I got to finish my defense and my chapters.
I see. So at Ambodot, what are you doing?
At Ambodot, I'm in charge with kind of starting the salmon monitoring program for the Klamath tribes. And so right now, most of our goals and objectives are just documenting where fish are on the landscape following dam removal. But in the coming years, we'll ramp up that program to incorporate, you know, studies of looking at, you know, productivity of juvenile outmigration, using radio telemetry to understand kind of fine-scale habitat use in the lake of adults, and as well as the core areas of spawning that they're going to.
If I may back up, before we get into the salmon monitoring, what did you learn about the Red Band trout?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is an endangered species, correct?
The Red Band trout?
Yeah.
No, they are not listed under the ESA.
Really?
Nope. They were petitioned to be listed back in the 90s, but they were denied listing.
But there's a catch and release here because they're so...
Yeah, so
limited.
So the state, the state makes their own regulations as far as how the recreational fishery will be managed and regulated. But at the federal level, they are not listed. But I believe at the state level, they're a species of concern.
And you can't keep them if you catch them, unless you're tribal.
No, you can harvest red bands in the upper basin. You're allowed one fish per day. I think it's a 15-inch minimum length. In the lake.
Wow. Yep. I should get out there and start fishing. I keep buying a fishing license, but never fish.
Yeah.
I just know a lot of people throw it back.
Yeah, there are a lot of specialized restrictions, particularly during summer when the fish are taking refuge in the cold water areas of the basin. So I believe in the Williamson and the Wood River, it's catch and release, I think. But I believe you can harvest in Pelican Bay.
Okay, so it can vary from waterways.
Correct. Yeah. Time of year and waterways, it varies.
The safest thing is catch and release. You don't need them. Keep the brown trout, well, what about rainbow?
So rainbow trout and red band trout, they're kind of like our kind of the drunk drawer of how we describe the genetic and kind of subspecies diversity that we have in Omicus, Oncorhynchus micus, which is the species for rainbow trout, red band trout. But in the Upper Klamath Basin, the big migratory lake fish that we all see caught out of the Upper Klamath Lake and the Williamson Rivers, those we classify as a red band trout. Genetically, they key out and are very distinguishable from other rainbow or other red band populations. But generally speaking, we term rainbow trout for those that occupy coastal areas or that are west of the Cascade Range, like in the Columbia River drainage, or those that are found up north, like in Alaska and such. But red band trout, we tend to classify those as Omicus that are found east of the Cascade Range in the Columbia River Basin, or those that are found inland, like in the upper Sacramento River drainage, or in the Upper Klamath Basin, like we have here. I was just going to say, and generally speaking, red band trout are a desert adapted form of Omicus, whereas a rainbow trout are a coastal form.
Very good. Thank you. Clarification, finally.
Yeah, there's still a lot that's muddying up the water, but we're starting to get a better idea of what we have out in the landscape.
What about color-wise? Do you see a difference in the rainbow coastal trout and the red band?
Yeah, so probably the most striking and kind of easy to see difference between rainbow and red band would be the spotting pattern. Generally speaking, rainbow trout they're much more heavily spotted. They tend to have spotting throughout the body below the lateral line. And the spots tend to be smaller and fine and round. Whereas red band trout, they can have more irregular shaping of the spots. They tend to be much more reduced and spaced out, concentrated towards the caudal fin area and above the lateral line. And then in terms of coloration, red band tend to be more drab. They don't get the kind of striking bright colors that you see in rainbow trout, although they do assume their own spawning colors that can be quite beautiful. But you don't get the kind of bright reds. And from my experience from the spawning fish that I've observed, red bands tend to be a lot darker red, a maroon, or even a purple in some cases.
Then we have our bull trout. Is that endangered?
Yes, the bull trout are, I believe their status under the ESA is threatened. And so there are strict regulations at the federal level and the state level that limit, you know, any sort of harm that could be done to that species.
They're both native to the waters here.
Correct.
Red band and bull.
Yep, correct.
Both struggling.
One more struggling
than the other.
Correct, yep.
When you did your research on the red band, what did you find out?
So the first project that I worked on was on a radio telemetry project on adult red band of Upper Klamath Lake. And so we surgically implemented around 100 radio tags onto these big, large trout right out of Upper Klamath Lake. We used hook and line sampling to be able to get our hands on the fish, followed them around for about a year. What we documented is that they make two large-scale migrations, population-level large-scale migrations. One migration is predominantly during winter, where they're migrating to go and spawn in the tributaries of Upper Klamath Lake. So starting in fall, they're in the lake. In winter, they migrate to their tributaries to spawn. Then they come back into the lake in spring and regain condition by foraging on mostly minnows in the lake. And then in summertime, they make another migration to thermal refuge habitat. As lake water quality deteriorates, they make migrations to groundwater-dominated areas such as Pelican Bay, the Wood, and the Williamson River to seek refuge from the stressful water quality conditions found in Upper Klamath Lake during summer.
So they've adapted to their environment to survive.
Seems that way. They seem like they got it pretty figured out. They know where to be when it's right and when to leave when it's not.
Smart.
Yeah.
You don't give trout enough credit, I don't think, for their intelligence.
I don't think we do. Yep. And this is, I think, looking to how adult red band trout navigate up the Upper Klamath Basin, I think there's a lot of insight and hope that we can gain from those observations for salmon returning to the Upper Klamath Basin. Mainly just that salmon and trout have a strong propensity to migrate to thermal refuge when water quality conditions deteriorate.
Thermal refuge.
Thermal refuge. When water gets too warm, they migrate to water that provides refuge thermally.
Is that the percolating springs coming up?
Yep, that's what that is, yep. Yeah, and so when thinking about salmon returning to the Upper Klamath Basin, I know there's been a lot of focus on poor water quality conditions in Lake Juana and Upper Klamath Lake, but I like to look at Red Band and see how they've how they're able to tackle the challenges that the Upper Klamath Basin provides to gain insight on what salmon might do. And when you look at Red Band trout, their ability to migrate between foraging and thermal refuge habitats, and when you look at other salmon populations and their propensity to migrate to thermal refuge habitat, what it really shows is that salmon and trout, they're very skillful in navigating challenging water quality conditions. And it's likely that salmon are going to respond in a similar way to red band trout in the Upper Klamath Basin, and that they're not going to be moving through the lake system when water quality is poor. They're going to be taking up refuge in those cool habitats that are influenced by groundwater, and waiting until the fall and spring, the shoulder seasons when water quality is good, to make their movements through the system.
So if the red band salmon are going to the same thermal refuges, will there be competition? Will they be pushing each other out?
Well, I mean, I think, I speculate and hypothesize that there will be some level of competition, but these species, they've co-evolved together on this landscape for millennia, and so I suspect that whatever competition does exist isn't going to be such that there any real threat to the trend or status of either population.
They can't interbreed, can they?
Nope. I think coho and chinook can produce hybrids. I know some of the salmon species can, but no. Omychus or red band and rainbow trout, they are only able to produce hybrids with cutthroat trout, is what I understand.
So the red band trout originally could utilize an entire lake of Upper Klamath Lake when it was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So their populations must have been dramatically larger when they had a full body of water that they could use without having to find escapement to get out of that water.
Yep, it's likely. I mean, Upper Klamath Lake is naturally productive, and so it's, and I'm speculating here, but I would have suspected that, at least for a few weeks out of the year, the lake would have become thermally stressful. And so you may have still seen those kind of movement patterns even historically. But certainly the intensity of the algal blooms and the time frame at which those algal blooms exist and whatnot have likely, increased their reliance on thermal refuge habitats. And the other thing, too, is, we've lost a lot of thermal refuge habitats as well. There's been increased groundwater pumping and hydrological modifications of groundwater habitats that we have. So that's been reduced as well. And so, but yeah, definitely historically there would have been more suitable habitat for them to occupy.
How much of a dramatic increase or decrease, should I say, has taken place with the trout over 50 years, 100 years?
So I can't speak on that for certain, because I don't have any historical data to, compare current estimates, current population trends to. But what I can say is that, there's a lot of habitat out in the landscape that was once historically occupied by red band trout that are now dominated by invasive trout like the brooks and the browns. And so I suspect that, there's been population declines and distribution and range contractions associated with, interspecific competition with other non-native salmonids.
As for the salmon, we have the movement now of salmon into tributaries for the first time in 100 years plus. As you monitor these salmon, how do you go about it? What's your objective and what can we learn?
So we're working really closely with the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife right now to tackle monitoring of returning salmon to the Upper Klamath Basin. And we're doing so by splitting up the Upper Klamath Basin kind of in two. So everything from the Link River down, ODFW is tasked with tackling that part of the system's monitoring. And everything from the Link River up, the Klamath Tribes is tasked with monitoring that region of the basin. And so how we're tackling monitoring is we're exploiting a few different strategies. We're using sonar imaging. We're using radio telemetry. We're using pit tags, and we're also using visual surveys. And so for the radio telemetry portion of our strategy, every Thursday we have crews going down into California with the Karuk tribes, and they're netting adult fall Chinook, and we're going to be tagging those individuals. We have 15 stationary radio telemetry receivers distributed from just downstream of the Iron Gate dam footprint all the way up to the tributaries of Upper Klamath Lake. We have, I believe, 11 stations, radio telemetry stations, from state line to the upper basin. And so the goal of this system of telemetry stations is to be able to document tagged individuals migrating through the system so that we can understand where they're going and when they're going there. Visual surveys will give us a better idea of run size, looking at, you know, carcasses and reds and counting abundance out in the landscape. And then pit tags will hopefully in the future we'll get our hands on, you know, naturally produced juveniles, and we'll be able to pit tag those. And there's a vast array there's a vast network of pit tag arrays distributed throughout the basin that USGS operates. And so hopefully in the next coming years, we'll be able to detect returning adult salmon that were once pit tagged as juveniles and see where they go, when they go.
So me and my new reporter, Chris German, we went and checked out the Link River Dam, Link River Dam. We went there the other day just to get a close-up look at it finally for the first time. I've never seen it really. Because I wanted to see the fish ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that white, large step that goes, you know, you can't miss it. It's near the dirt road.
Yep, that's it.
Is that going to work? Are there salmon going to be able to get up that thing and make it to the other side?
Yeah, so the Link River ladder is not the fish passage structure that we're concerned about. That's actually the one at Keno Dam. That's the ladder that needs the most work. From my understanding, the Link River ladder actually was refurbished within the last decade to meet federal standards for fish passage. Again, my understanding is that ladder is suitable for salmon passage, whereas the Keno ladder is not up to federal standards for fish passage. And in particular, there is concern over the attracting flows. So how much water is coming out of the ladder to attract fish. They think that there's not enough coming out of there. But there's going to be a study done within the coming weeks, a feasibility analysis, looking at what kinds of things can be done to improve fish passage at that location.
At the Keno Dam?
At the Keno Dam.
We tried to get out there. We couldn't find it. We couldn't find the access road.
Yeah, it's a mess back there. There's logging roads and hydropower roads and fishing roads.
Because we wanted to see the fish ladder.
Yep. Yeah.
What? How does it differ in the way it looks and is constructed compared to the Link River ladder?
Superficially, they look very similar. It's, you know, similar design in that it's kind of got, you know, it kind of has an elbow where it changes direction so that the gradient isn't as steep. Kind of like a switchback on a trail. But yeah, superficially they look very similar. I just know that the attracting flows are not up to standard, at the Keno ladder, whereas they're sufficient at the Link River ladder.
What is that contract? What did you say?
Attracting flows.
What is that?
So it's, and again, my understanding is it's the water that's coming out of the passage structure. The more water you have, the more attraction that salmon are going to have towards that. Cause they think that they can, that's the path to migrate upstream.
So they make it over the Link River Dam through the ladder, and then they get on the other side. They're on their way into Upper Klamath Lake at that point. What are their challenges? We were there the other day, very shallow water.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have to be a certain depth for them to be able to get from that point into the lake? Temperature, algae bloom, they're entering a toxic zone.
Yep. Well, it's seasonally toxic.
Seasonally toxic. So is the season right for the salmon to arrive, or is it conflicting?
So that's going to be, an annual, dependent on an annual basis. You know, the conditions are going to differ from year to year.
They usually get worse later in the summer, right?
Correct, yeah.
Getting towards fall.
Yeah, so there's two life histories of salmon that for Chinook salmon, we expect two life histories to be present in the upper basin, spring Chinook and fall Chinook. The difference between those two life histories, they both spawn at the same time around fall, but it's the timing of their freshwater entry that differs. So fall Chinook, as their name implies, they're migrating in fall. So they enter the freshwater environment in fall and get up to their spawning grounds in fall and spawn. Spring Chinook, they're going to be migrating during spring peak flows. And then they're going to oversummer in the freshwater environment until the subsequent fall and then spawn. And so those are two pretty striking differences when you're thinking about the Upper Klamath Basin and water quality and the challenges that that might impose on these migrating fish. In particular, your fall Chinook, they're going to be migrating through Lake Juana and Upper Klamath Lake, you know, in September and October and potentially even late August. Those are when water quality is a potential hazard for those fish. And so I hypothesize and suspect that fall Chinook are going to have the greatest challenges of recovery in the Upper Klamath Basin just due to those constraints associated with needing to move through the system when water quality isn't ideal. Whereas spring Chinook are going to be migrating through the freshwater system when water quality is totally fine. You know, that seasonal period when it's not bad. And so as long as, you know, they have suitable oversummering habitat, then water quality associated with Lake Juana and Upper Klamath Lake shouldn't be an issue for that life history. And fortunately for spring Chinook and the community up here, we have substantial groundwater inputs that are very ideal for oversummering habitat for spring Chinook salmon. So they got the habitats that they need in order to be very successful.
The Link River Dam. It was originally built for regulating the water depths of the lake. Or
that's my understanding. I'm not sure, but
it wasn't ever hydropower.
I think it can produce hydropower, but you know, I'm not sure as to what the motive was behind putting that structure.
What was the year that was built? We looked it up. 1950s. 1967, where the current structure is?
What I do know is that I believe it was 64, there was a big flood that ripped out the Needle Dam at Keno, and that motivated them to put the current Keno structure in for flood control. So that could have been in response to the bad flood in 64, but...
Yeah, I was wondering about that. We passed a road that's called the Needle Dam Road.
Yep.
I'm like, Needle Dam?
Yep.
There's a dam back there, but it's no longer.
It was, and then it got, flooded away from what I understand.
Is it possible the Link River Dam could be removed? Do we need it?
I mean, I don't think we need any fish barriers. But
we need the Keno Dam? Is flooding a problem? It seems like drought's a problem.
I know. How ironic is it? I think it's difficult to answer that question. You know, it's an easier question to answer when there's not a bunch of people dependent on a new set of conditions. And so like the whole system's been heavily altered. My understanding is that they had to explode or dynamite a lot of the rock reef that was present at the outlet of Upper Klamath Lake to get the Link River Dam in. And so like things like that, like removing that dam, you're not returning the system to the same state it was because of, I mean, we directly altered the bathymetry of the channel. I don't know what that would look like. I definitely don't want it there personally. It'd be nice if there wasn't any dams.
Well, I just wonder if that wish is more than just two guys talking and it goes across a wide spectrum.
Yeah, I think
1921 was when the Link River Dam was initially put in. Thank you very much, Christopher German, statistician for the show.
Yeah, I think serious conversations regarding dam removal are more likely to be had around the Keno Dam structure, because currently the fish passage is not up to par. It needs to be modified just to get it up to par, and then you have the question of this barrier is still a ticking time. You know, it's every hydropower facility has a date at which they'll no longer be able to operate and they need to be refurbished. And so I wonder, you know, what, you know, how much is it going to cost to get Fish Passage up to par versus how much is it going to cost to remove the structure entirely? It could be similar. I'm not sure. But yeah, it's those conversations are happening.
Yeah, right now they are.
Yep.
Me and you.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, when Chris and I were having it when we were walking to the Link River Dam and in the car, you know, this topic of conversation we're having, I said, is probably starting with a lot of people now that four dams have been removed.
Yep.
The dam removal is on our minds.
Yep.
And their relevance today compared to when they were first put in 80 years ago or more.
Yep. And I think, you know, the conversations are happening a lot sooner than we anticipated just in terms of how quickly fish have returned. I think it's safe to say that not many of us were expecting to see fish migrate past Spencer Creek, but we are seeing that. Mm. We're seeing fish up in the Keno Reach now.
Well, tear it down and they will come.
that's all it takes. It seems like if fish have access to the right habitats, then they use them.
How does where are they coming from when they go to the Keno Dam? They're coming from the upper Klamath River area as well, and then they go into the creeks and then find their way into that area. What's their trajectory to get to the Keno Dam?
So they're migrating from the ocean into the Klamath River.
Yeah.
Migrating up the Klamath River, you know, through Iron Gate and the Kopp Cove, former dam reaches.
And then they branch off because they're not going the same route as the Link River Dam fish.
So the Link River and the Keno Dam are hydrologically connected through Lake Juana. So Lake Juana is functionally the Klamath River.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So they're all in there and then they branch off to the two different dams?
So
what's their map?
So there's one main vein, which is the Klamath River. And that flows upstream through Keno, through Lake Juana, and up to the Link River Ladder.
Oh, okay. So they got to go through Keno first?
They got to go through Keno first, and then they have to go through the Link Ladder.
Well, if they can't get through Keno, they're never going to get to the Link Ladder.
That is correct.
So we can't expect salmon to get to where they should be going.
So although the fish passage structure at Keno is not up to federal standards, it doesn't mean that it can't pass fish. It just means that it's not up to standard. And so we know that rainbow trout, or red band trout, rather, have successfully navigated that fish passage structure. And there is unverified reports that came in yesterday of salmon in the Keno Ladder making their way through it. So unverified, but BOR staff did observe large fish in the Keno Ladder. So it is, the possibility exists that fish have already passed through that structure and are on their way here. I mean, there could be fish in the tributaries of Upper Klamath Lake right now.
You're talking salmon, Chinook.
Salmon, Chinook, yeah.
Let's be clear about that.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's a lot of fish out
Don't want to get people too excited. But, yeah.
Salmon, and did you say red band are also going up the ladders or just the salmon?
Yeah, there's limited movement of red band trout through those ladders.
So we've got that little dilemma of an outdated fish ladder that they first have to navigate. Then they get to the Link River. It's quite the challenge for these fish.
Yes, it is. Yep. But a lot less challenging than four complete barriers,
yeah.
You know. So
one dam at a time.
Yep, one dam at a time. The river's free-flowing, and so we'll at least have the opportunity to, you know, see what kind of bottlenecks exist out in the landscape.
I have another question from our statistician. How many salmon, what, sonar?
So far this year. So I just got counts today from Spencer Creek. They counted over 100 fish and
over 100 Chinook.
Over 100 adult spawning fall Chinook salmon in just Spencer Creek. And then out at the mouth, there was an additional 30. And that does not account for the spawning that's occurring in the main stem that it appears to be substantial as well. So the most conservative estimate that I could give you is at an absolute minimum, 130. At an absolute maximum, you know, if you're assuming 500, 200 to 500 spawners throughout the main stem, between the former, you know, dam footprints, I would, you know, you're looking at between 500 and 1,000 fish. But
not a bad start.
Not a bad start.
500 to 1,000.
When when me and my colleagues were first talking about, you know, where do you guys think fish are going to come back to? Where do you think they're going to get back to first? We all kind of agreed that if one fish makes it to Spencer Creek, this was an overwhelming success.
To make it to Spencer Creek, they have to go through the two dams, the Link and the Keno?
No, Spencer Creek below
before that.
Yep.
So there's where you have your success story now. But if you see them later over the dams, that's even a bigger
success story. Bigger success
story. They're closer to their...
where they want to be.
Yeah, their final destination.
Yep.
But yet they're spawning in Spencer Creek. They wouldn't be, those salmon aren't looking to get to the tributaries of the Upper Klamath Lake?
Apparently not, you know.
They just decide to cut it off there?
If you know what salmon think, please let me know.
Well, it's interesting. You get this large spawning going on before their historical run ends.
Yeah, and so another interesting thing to think about is, you know, Jenny Creek is the first, my understanding is it's the first or one of the first tributaries that they pass, that's a newly available habitat post dam removal that they have to pass. And yes, fish went up Jenny Creek, but a bunch of fish decided not to go up Jenny Creek and go up to Spencer. And so some fish are not wanting to go up Spencer and are going to keep going. But it's fascinating to think about all this availability and high quality habitat and the decision-making process that these salmon have, because they're choosing to skip some really high quality habitat in the search of others.
And they're choosing not to go up a couple of dam ladders that they may not make it up.
Yep.
Not that they know they're there.
Potentially though, some could have swam up and, you know, deemed it too difficult for
But back it up, kids.
Yep.
This isn't working.
Yep. But the link ladder is effective at passing fish. So it's really Keno that all eyes are on in terms of it being a barrier to migration to the upper basin. But, you know, it's encouraging to hear reports of salmon in the ladder, but it'd be nice to get those verified. But even if, you know, even if fish aren't able to navigate that structure, that just, you know, in some ways it's a blessing in disguise, because it's just going to, you know, make the argument for addressing that, the challenges associated with that structure a lot stronger. And I think those issues will get addressed faster.
And those issues weren't addressed as they were planning the four dam removal?
Well, there is passage. So that's the thing is, you know, the first objective is get the river free flowing. And those were those four dams were the structures that were impeding access to the upper basin. Yes, Keno fish passage is not ideal, but fish theoretically can get past that structure. And how I look at it to kind of, you know, just to be clear, the Keno fish ladder needs to be refurbished. It needs to be updated. But to keep myself, you know, sleeping through the night, I like to think of other hydrologic challenges that are natural that salmon have to navigate. And, you know, there's waterfalls that are 10, 20 feet high that these fish are able to navigate to get to their natal spawning areas. And so when you compare a 20-foot waterfall to the fish Keno ladder, you know, that's a more challenging barrier to get past. And so for me, I seek hope in just the amazing capabilities that salmon have to navigate through challenging hydrologic pathways. And so I'm confident that, yeah, it's a barrier and it's going to slow fish down. But, you know, I have faith in the ability of these fish to figure it out. And again, this is just this year, you know, in the coming years. Next year, we're going to be having a very different conversation. You know, passage will be improved and whatnot.
At the Keno?
At the Keno, yeah. Yeah, so like I said, they're doing a study right now to assess what kind of changes can be made.
Quickly,
yeah. To address some of the concerns with that structure.
See, we were onto something, Chris, going out there. We're trying to see. We wanted to see the ladder. I said, what kind of ladder do they have for these fish? You know, what kind of condition is it in?
Yep. Yeah, you guys are doing the right thing. The most important part of, you know, anything fish conservation is getting your eyes out in the landscape and seeing what's going on.
Yeah. Boots on the water.
Boots on the water is the most best scientific sampling tool you have.
Right on. Jordan Ortega, our fish expert today for AmboDot, monitoring the salmon, bringing us breaking news. Again, how many fish did we see spawning in the Spencer Creek?
100 fish today and 30 out at the mouth. So at minimum in Spencer, 130.
Wow.
Yep.
You heard it first today on the Klamath Tribes podcast. Thank you, Jordan. Good work.
Appreciate you having me, Ken.
I'm Ken Smith. You've been listening to the Klamath Tribes podcast. We will talk again.